It is winter in Area X, the mysterious wilderness that has defied explanation for 30 years, rebuffing expedition after expedition, refusing to reveal its secrets. As Area X expands, the agency tasked with investigating and overseeing it, the Southern Reach, has collapsed in on itself in confusion. Now one last desperate team crosses the border, determined to reach a remote island that may hold the answers they've been seeking. If they fail, the outer world is in peril. Meanwhile, acceptance tunnels ever deeper into the circumstances surrounding the creation of Area X. What initiated this unnatural upheaval? Among the many who have tried, who has gotten close to understanding Area X, and who may have been corrupted by it? In this last installment of Jeff Vandermeer's Southern Reach trilogy, the mysteries of Area X may be solved, but their consequences and implications are no less profound or terrifying. I'm Jason Squamata. I'm here with my lovely cohorts, Pat Chinowski, Mark Savage, and Kate Fenker, to discuss the final book in Jeff Vandermeer's Southern Reach trilogy, Acceptance. This is Book Circle Online.
From the Library of Maria Menounos, this is Book Circle Online, featuring in-depth discussion, insight, news, and commentary on all the world's leading book titles and their authors. And now, Book Circle Online.
Okay, well, here we are. Welcome back to Book Circle Online. This is Jason Squamata. Today, we are taking our third and final pass at the turbulent mercurial territory of Area X. We are covering Acceptance, the third book in the Southern Reach trilogy by our friend Jeff Vandermeer. And, well, what a trilogy it's been. Let's talk about some brief furious impressions we might have about the book as a whole. Acceptance, Pat.
What a long, strange trilogy it's been.
Indeed.
What I really have appreciated in the whole of this trilogy is the dramatic difference in the voices among the three different books.
Uh-huh.
The first one was completely vague and obfuscating and cloudy and foggy and what the heck is going on here kind of thing. The second one, sort of, so you started getting some inklings. The people were much more clearly portrayed, that sort of thing. And this one, as it shifts from point of view to point of view, it seems so straightforward, which it's not,
right?
Because none of these are. But in comparison to the other two,
yes,
it's been a very interesting progression in voice.
Indeed. Okay, and I could I agree wholeheartedly with what you said, but at the same time, I feel like there's this curious way in which it has gotten more nebulous and diffuse as it goes.
Yeah,
because that first book, for all of its ambiguities, this adventure of these strange people.
It was one episode.
Right. Yeah. And so as the sort of shifting loyalties and the enduring unknowability of Area X evolves across these books, this weird expansion and contraction thing, as if the trilogy itself were alive, it becomes more distinct and high res as it goes and more nebulous and
exactly
unknowable.
And shifting loyalties, I would ascribe only to the second book, actually, when you put it that way.
Sure.
I see that nowhere, sort of, in the first one, and not even in here. It's all these different stories. What were you going to say, Kate? Sorry.
Oh, that just what you were saying, it's like in how they're always saying in science, the more you know, the more that you don't know, and the more that things are brought into tight, strong focus. This is not a hallucination. This is a description of something that definitely exists. This is what we're looking at.
It's happening.
And this is happening. This object exists. This incarnation of a persona exists. This cell phone is ambulating itself across the floor. And none of this helps explain anything. It only makes bigger questions.
Right.
That's where the book being called Acceptance seems such a good title, because in some way the characters have to accept the unknowing of the situation.
And they do.
The reader may be frustrated. I didn't feel that way, but I can see how people might get to the end and go, huh? There must be more. But I think he's boldly reaching for something bigger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Throughout this whole thing, he is reaching for something very, very
and in a way,
big.
In a way, the first book, by setting up this kind of expedition, is almost, you could almost imagine a conventional, almost Shackleton story, or even Lord of the Rings. We're going on a journey.
Right.
We have to go,
it's
and we know what we need
epic
to do.
Journey.
And the second one is almost the conventional John le Carré spy novel. Set in an office, everybody's paranoid. And by the third one, you see, it's almost like he's saying these narrative modes that we know and trust, in the face of the unknowable, are useless.
Right.
We have to shed those.
Yes, you might not be the adventurer. You might be the landscape.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, you were comparing the trilogy and the titles in particular to your work day today earlier when you were talking.
Yeah. You know, and when you wake up, you want to go to work. You don't want to go to work. It's annihilation going to work.
An annihilation.
You have to face authority.
Right.
But you come to accept that for better or worse, the situation you're part of.
Right. Yes. And in the way that Area X achieves most of the ground it gains through a kind of seduction. You know, also these kind of non-human entities in our daily modern lives that assimilate us in
various
ways.
Yeah, they may or may not be nefarious, but they seem to have consequences.
The moaning pig-like manager at work.
Yes.
You know.
Who is not to name any names. Lowry. Let's talk now.
Speaking of bosses.
Yes. I mean, despite the fact that most of the major characters in this trilogy at one point or another kind of slough the lineaments of identity and recede into this teeming
most
ecology.
Of them have no names.
Yes.
True.
The ones that do have names are either especially endearing or Lowry. I love that his function is ambiguous.
Like the seasoning salt. He adds flavor. But what is he actually made of? If you look at it, it's MSG.
Yeah, MSG. That's all. Right? Okay. Does nothing for the body.
Yeah.
Okay. Just lends spice to the interactions of the components within the
and
body.
And somehow increases your appetite, but you're not quite sure why.
Right.
But it's evil.
Yeah, something fundamentally officiated, you know, like evil, definitely. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Lowry is really vain.
Yes.
Lowry is like almost living on a celebrity from an expedition. He's almost like creating this kind of Jacques Cousteau for romantic, I've been here, I know things. But he combines that with this strange kind of bureaucratic authority.
Right. Well, his journey, that first expedition into Area X, the way that Area X has of reflecting the kind of needs and uncertainties of the human beings who are entering it.
Right.
All this ambiguity and murkiness and nebulousness had not yet accrued. There was still a fundamental, we don't know what's happening. Let's get to the bottom of this. But
let's be scientists.
Yes, let's be scientists. But he, you know, clearly, you know, there are references to him with his jutting jaw as being this sort of, you know, like hero figure, this sort of clip art hero figure that was going to fix this, and this, you know, astronaut entering
the certainly
the
how
void.
He sees himself.
Oh, certainly, yeah. Despite the decay that's accrued behind that mask, but you can see how his experience of Area X was of like a mysterious aberration that needed to be tamed in the terms of his adventurous, ego-heavy...
In the narrative that he tells himself.
Yes.
And other people.
Right, yes. Whereas, you know, when it's the... when we're talking about members of the 5th, 8th expedition or the 10th, 11th expedition, and this has just become this maze of unknowability, and there's... Even if the characters aren't in the moment aware of it, there's this creeping dread clinging to the whole enterprise. Their, you know, their egos maybe are not strong enough to withstand the turbulence of what's happening in that space. Mm. But it's interesting that, like, the most conventionally heroic figure in the book, someone would be the hero of a ecological disaster book 30 years ago, is the closest thing to a human villain.
Yeah, well, it's like, in a way, it's like how you might think of a hero descending. You know, if you read Victorian stories of great explorers descending into the dark continent and they're bravely facing up to the savages that they find there, that kind of thing now is just filled with, for us, filled with horrible actions.
Right. Right.
By our forefathers.
Sure. Yeah. Right.
These horrible and in a way Lowry in his small pocket can enjoy a celebrity. His legacy, if there is any legacy beyond this, he won't be remembered as a great man.
Right.
He has to live on the fumes in the present.
Taming Area X. Area X is clearly fixing the ecological disaster that Earth has wreaked upon itself.
Right, right.
Whether that means it's going to annihilate everybody on Earth while it does that.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Well, every human, because animals...
Right.
Oh, yeah.
What do we see any suffering animals? We see suffering...
playing in the midst of all this drama.
The rabbits disappear.
Right.
We see the rabbits disappear. We don't see...
where they end up.
Yeah. And it seems like... that humans are the only ones who have a problem with with Area X.
Yeah.
It feels like it's our problem, like in a way that we can't. Some of the characters, especially Control, keep seeing it as this adversary, nature.
Right.
Right.
He doesn't seem to understand that our humans' place in nature is far more complicated than that.
Yeah.
It's just this. What is it doing? We're going to go in there and we're going to face up to it. And he's kind of psyching himself up for a brave action.
Right.
He doesn't know what it might be.
Yeah.
But he just feels to me like a hiker wearing the wrong shoes all the time.
Uh-huh, right,
going through
right.
This. Yeah. What is this? Oh, this outdoors. It's scary. It's tough. It's and he's, for all his intelligence, is fundamentally stupid.
Yeah.
When it comes to...
Well, on the edge of this thing, I feel like he's doomed to completely run in circles until it assimilates itself, because ultimately, I mean, my read of how this all plays out in Acceptance is that... Area X is not this invasive force from another universe. It's this way of seeing that infects the ecology, and planet Earth is remembering that it is Area X. And, you know, and the growth of this territory means that more and more of the living organisms on the surface of this planet are sloughing, you know, the self-deceptions, the egos.
That have led to the horrible outcome
that
we started with.
It's an ecology hurting itself because it doesn't imagines, because there's a part of it that imagines that it is separate from
the mix. I like that description of it, Jason, because there's other things postulated, parallel universes.
Sure.
Are we actually on a different planet, in a different solar system? Is that what's happening to us? Is that what happened when we dived into that pool up in Maine?
Right.
You know, I like that characterization of it more and more of the planet is sloughing off this false, corroded layers, you know, that it's put onto itself.
Yeah, and losing the illusion of its disconnectedness from the rest of the cosmos. I mean, these sort of like, you know, wormholes that connect it to these other worlds, or the idea that, you know, this first germ of Area X came from another place.
Yeah, and the only organisms that harms are people.
Yeah, and the illusions of people, the illusions that we can conquer. This nature is something out there, and we go into it and we conquer it. We climb these mountains, we put flags on the top of them, and we say, look at this guy, what a great guy. In light of Area X, those kind of achievements just seem, it's like you built a sandcastle, well done.
Uh-huh.
You know? They seem nothing.
Whereas the biologist who loved to stare into the tide pools, I mean, she really flourished in her assimilation.
She's the only one who really seems to...
Well, she's the only one we see.
Yeah, the only one we see.
We don't know what the rest of all the, you know.
She's the only character who shows,
evolution.
Displays any sign of acceptance of Area X. And it's partly because she can function in the moment. She can sit there and look at the blades of grass moving and enjoy that.
Right, 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 right.
Control can't even see them.
Yeah.
He's wondering why they're moving when he can't feel a wind.
Indeed, indeed. Well, I mean, she's been taken to that place by her experience in Annihilation.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, she did, you know, we were introduced to her in this web of paranoia.
As a questioning She was asking lots of questions.
Right, yeah.
Well, and
yes.
She never quite fit in anywhere else that she was.
Yeah.
This was kind of, it seemed like all her life was leading here.
Right, yeah. And it got there, and it's like the biologist is sloughed, and she's part of this mix now that emerges as gigantic, you know, leviathanic creatures with too many eyes.
Stone
and
wave
uh-huh.
that just stops short of, you know, subsuming the entire reflected lighthouse on the island.
Yeah, but she is somehow woven into that phenomenon and this rippling in the sky. And, of course, most obviously in, you know, in Area X grows a copy of her, Ghostbird.
Ghostbird.
Who
is almost like the gone native version. I imagine her walking around in bare feet.
Sure. Yeah. And Ghostbird's journey.
Much like Kevin Costner in Dances with Wolves.
In a way.
Right.
I was picturing her in the army regulation jacket.
I know you were. Uh-huh. I just gave voice to your inner
voice. Right. And that would be a marvelous journey if in the film version of Kevin Costner is cast as Lowry, then he can, you know.
That's a good shout. That's a good shout because,
something that occurred to me when you were just describing the biologist and what she became, it's a god image too. The many eyes that both terrible and beautiful to look upon.
Right.
Like you can't bear to look at it.
Yeah.
And yet it's there.
Right.
Totally. You're making me think.
Yeah. Well, you know, and it's almost even that vast, unknowable, baffling creature is a somewhat knowable nodule of this great macro consciousness. It's growing to scare
because
us.
Because it's tangible.
To spook us.
You can
see
it. Yeah.
Right. And so even that is a kind of degradation and is closer to these scurrying human beings.
Well, it's
than,
something
right,
that they can understand.
You know. Yeah.
Kind of.
Right.
This is something
right.
to run away from,
yes.
at the very least.
Right. Which is preferable to something that is part and parcel of every atom of our being and everything around us. To imagine that that is the enemy of your sense of self is that's why I feel like this book's innovation on the Lovecraftian equation is beautiful because it's it's imagining that the human race is an illness that Cthulhu is having, and Cthulhu as the embodiment of wild indifferent nature, and but there's this cheerful nihilism in it that I think trumps Lovecraft in that, you know, like all the torment of creatures on the edge of madness as they stare into this totality that dwarfs not just them but every human achievement. It exposes that drama as being silly, and the acceptance. I feel like. I mean, the apocalypse does not get resolved. I mean, the apocalypse that it paints gets more and more ambiguous, and it invites us into an embrace of the end of everything that we consider important or human or worthwhile.
As part of the journey.
Yeah.
Because a more conventional narrative might have the humans finding a way to stop this apocalypse and return things to whatever normal was.
Which was horrible pollution. And
They would all lose and we would understand their defeat.
Yeah.
As it is, that indifference of Area X is one of the most challenging things.
Right, right.
It would be like Lord of the Rings where, you know, Frodo throws the ring into the pit of fire and so what? It doesn't change anything. You think that stops you being bad people? You're all bad people.
Right. Yes.
And you're idiots for going on such a quest.
Yeah.
And in a way, Control still thinks in those conventional terms.
Right.
In some way, he's trying to psych himself up to be brave enough to do something. He has no idea what it might be.
Yeah, because as much as he's still like fixated and clinging to the lineaments of his identity and the whittled figure that his father made and like his issues with his mother and stuff, I mean, he has a moral character that Lowry does not have.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I mean, so all Lowry has is the lineaments of his identity and his manipulations of people and what a great schemer he is and all this espionage. Whereas, you know, Control, it might be the same journey with each of these characters. They're just sloughing layer.
Well, they're all lonely people in various ways.
Right.
People who
absolutely
may have lost something. They're all sentimental, not outrageously so, but just in a very human way, about people they've lost, people they miss,
right?
People from the past. You don't really witness any. The only like relatively satisfying relationships I can think of revolve around Saul, the lighthouse keeper.
Yes.
Oh, so can we go back? Saul. Saul comes in. We understand he's the lighthouse keeper.
Right.
Gloria comes in.
Yes.
We understand.
Who grows up to be the director.
Exactly.
Yes. They have a very sweet relationship.
So go ahead with what you're saying.
And Saul has a relationship with Charlie,
yes,
the
mm-hmm.
fisherman. And we only see glimpses of this, but they're the only two relationships I can think of that offer comfort to the people in them.
Right.
Everybody else seems to be remembering relationships that may have offered comfort, like uh-huh. the dead father, the biologist's husband, mm-hmm. who even though their relationship wasn't perfect, she remembers him and misses him,
right.
which is something.
Right, mm-hmm. sure. Or even Gloria and Grace. Mm-hmm. I mean, even though they
yes.
they do seem to comfort each other, they're still ensconced in this struggle or
the
illusion
of
a struggle
of Southern
the
Reach.
Southern Reach. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But Saul and Gloria, you know, have this beautiful connection.
And they both lived inside the area that became Area X.
Right.
Well, and Saul was the lighthouse keeper.
Yes, who we've been getting flashes of throughout the books, throughout Annihilation and Authority. And
Kate, you were talking earlier yes. about how satisfying it would be now to go back and start reading again. Because when I was talking about
yeah.
how seeing that picture of the lighthouse keeper and the girl on the rocks and how it had significance in the very first book, but you didn't know why.
You know why.
And now it's like, oh, you're dying to see that again.
It's totally true. And I also noticed at the beginning of Acceptance, where very early on we get the point of view of the psychologist, who was a complete figure of like, what is the psychologist really about? And like the fact that he gave that to us, her point of view, was like, yes, like it was like candy. And
it
we
was
got
very
that.
Satisfying.
I mean, that was yeah. one of the best, most satisfying things. But yes, now that, but you're absolutely right that there are equal moments of satisfaction that would come with, now that we know this, can we go back and read those? I would say anyone who reads these, read them in a big clump all together.
Well, yeah, reading in one sitting. I mean, with Annihilation and Authority, circumstances conspired so that I kind of read each of those books in a pretty compressed chunk of time.
Me too. Yeah.
Acceptance was spread out a little bit more, and there were moments in it, and this is not a critique of its style, because everything that, you know, happened, and I just feel like Vandermeer is masterfully in control of his talent, and it felt like it was to effect. But I frequently said, did I just read this page? Like when you know, and then there will be something in the text that will indicate that one of the characters is experiencing time dilation.
Yep.
Or uncertainty about where they're coming from.
Yeah, you have to be on your game. Like, the book is not the easiest to absorb the whole thing.
Well, I think, in a way, it appears to be, the writing style, at least, very accessible.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. There's nothing weird about the language.
Totally.
About, but what's brilliant is how...
In this book, in the third book.
I would say in all three books, mm-hmm. they are accessible. You don't read it and go, what's this... He's not William Burroughs, you know. He's not.
Right.
He's not. It's not experimental fiction, in the kind of the language sense, anyway. So, there were parts of me after reading the first one that wanted this trilogy to descend into the writing down the tunnel, this kind of spiraling,
right.
descent into like quasi biblical nonsense. This kind of hogwash poetry that I really wanted that, but he refrained from that, if he ever even gave that a thought. And I think that in a way, the straighter language obscures the fact that they're deceptively confusing books, because you do think, which lighthouse am I in now?
Right.
He's told me clearly which one I'm in, but
right.
what lighthouse is this? And then there's a copy of the copy of it, and we're, it's like he's building in deja vus that you're not sure if you've caught on or if you're
right.
Did I just go back a page?
Right.
And that's hard to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's advanced.
That's it hard is to do.
Yeah.
Harder than the hogwash poetry.
Right. No. And,
which is written by Saul. Saul's the crawler.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's essentially meaningless.
It's so great.
It's like his. It's his memory. Just,
yeah.
It's his
it's
dream
his
writing.
Core as well, a preacher.
As a preacher. Yes.
That's just what he when he comes back to his true nature. That's what comes out of him.
Yes.
And it means that the words. Like it's in a way the books tell us that we could write whatever we want, but it's futile in the face of Area X. That's interesting.
Right.
Well, for a writer
and all these I mean that his graffiti and the journals of the different characters, the accumulated journals.
They just sit there in a pile.
They do, and you have this like pile of testaments to the last gasp of human consciousness at the threshold of this understanding. Oh my goodness, I'm all these other people too, and that duck and that leaf.
And there's this idea that a future without us wouldn't mourn us. It would just be, look at all these things they did. What
right.
is it?
It's yeah,
just, if they even notice.
Because human civilization and human consciousness is a toxic aberration. I feel like that's the sort of, you know... Like
and one of our big problems is we can't imagine individually the world beyond us.
Right.
As much as we think we know what death is, we can't imagine that things will just carry on without us
right.
and without people being irrevocably changed by our death.
Yeah, we can know it, but not be able to actually picture
it. And we know it's
it.
True. Yeah. It has to be true. Yeah. But we can't... that's one of the paradoxes.
I can picture conceiving something like this, spending a lot of time in the nature.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that's what it's about.
Right. And well,
the
yes.
bigger world. Anyway, go ahead.
Did you, you know, I was just thinking in a weird way, the nonsense spewing sermon, which is so beautiful, it kind of describes what's happening.
Like, yeah.
Because it's not, lest anybody get the wrong impression, this is not like nature as we know it is taking over humans.
Because we don't know it.
Right.
No, this is something else that absorbs and uses everything that humans have created and everything that's possible and beyond anything beyond that we can't even understand what it might be. But technology isn't like overrun by mold or something. No,
right.
Technology is
part of it.
A part of
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
This is something we don't experience yet.
Right. Well, when Area X generates a cell phone.
Yeah.
You know?
It's like, oh, uh-huh. yeah.
Right.
What?
Yeah. And almost a kind of, you know, to
and
me.
And names.
Right.
Like how it works with things that the identifiers and the things that are like all these products of human vanity, they don't disappear in this overtaking by nature.
Uh-huh.
This is a new overtaking by nature that's augmented by everything we've given it.
Which, yeah. Because we're part of nature.
And, yeah,
right.
And,
yeah.
And absolutely.
The cancer right. is part of the body.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And,
right.
And is
as soon as you understand
other.
It's not a binary,
right.
you have a
right.
hope of
yeah.
of dealing with Area X.
Well, the delusion of the cancer is that, I mean, it, you know, it's trying to replicate itself. It thinks it's at war with the body. It thinks it has to kill all these healthy cells, and you know, and it, I think an analog is a solid analog exists between this book's portrait of the human race and cancer in a body.
I think that the cancer isn't trying to kill anything; it's just trying to grow.
Yeah,
right, yeah.
And so it takes up resources
uh-huh.
yeah.
that the rest of the body needs, and that's what happens to the rest of the body. It's
right.
just being deprived,
sure,
and of space,
yeah,
of
yeah.
resources,
right,
yeah.
and that's why you die.
Right.
But the cancer itself isn't a hostile entity;
right.
it's just trying to live.
Yeah.
It's got a completely different
agenda,
method of organization
right.
too.
Yeah.
Like
right.
it's just.
Well, I love the cell phone. It actually, I knew something was going to happen with it. It was going to skitter away at some point. It surprised me that it took me as long as it did. But it seems like Area X's sense of humor in generating a cell phone, it seemed to indicate like people are not much more complicated to me than this cell phone is.
And it's not even like an iPhone. It's like a flip phone.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, let's be honest.
Such a cruel joke.
I love the humor in this one. There was so much more humor in this one.
Yeah.
Just the whole Seance and Science Brigade, the whole concept of that in itself was hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although not, you know, hippies and science have the same questions.
Right.
What's it all for? What's it all about? But then how, you know, the future, the people in years later looked at this and said, what does it stand for? And came up with all these. And it was hilarious. It was great.
Yeah.
It was nice to have that.
Right.
A leavening agent.
Yeah. Well, also, I mean, I feel like Saul himself.
Yeah.
Hearing Saul's story grounded all this in this beautiful way.
Yeah. And, he's lovely. Yeah. The portrait of him.
Yeah.
As a quiet, hardworking
man. And
the
way he dealt with Gloria, and how sweet that was. Mm-hmm.
And that his life is not, you know, like extraordinary on the surface, but like everything that we've experienced has grown out of it in these weird ways.
Absolutely.
Because he was ground zero.
Yeah.
The lighthouse was.
Right, right. And I, you know, and I mean, we've discussed this. I mean, most amazing books, I mean, are going to reward rereading, and you know, they're undisclosed treasures that every time we pass through them we'll see new things. But this trilogy in particular seems to have this beautifully circular structure where, I mean, so much of the stuff that's beautiful in this book is like finds its full efflorescence as a prologue to Annihilation.
The journey they're making at the end.
Yeah.
They make a journey in Annihilation.
Right. Yeah, there are repetitions in this book that are interesting, but they feel very different because you have a completely different understanding of what's going on.
Right, right.
Even if the journeys echo. And we know the journeys echo because there have been so many expeditions.
Yeah, yeah. But and the poetic repetitions, like Mark, when you mentioned that none of the animals are in any kind of trouble or strife in this story, and I love that whenever, you know, one of the characters kind of, you know, relinquishes all their drama and just observes nature, it's always creatures playing. Uh-huh. I mean, everyone's all consumed by regret or by longings or paranoia, but all these things are just at play all around
and
them.
And Ghostbird's accounts of being out in nature are some of the loveliest passages of this book. Just again and again, you get these really vivid descriptions that could be come from a nonfiction book about all kinds of regions. That it's just just drenched with this imagery, and she can see these things.
Yeah.
She notices these things, and what's interesting is where everybody else is questing and asking questions. She's stopping and looking around, and it made me think of Terrence Malick, the filmmaker, especially The Thin Red Line, where he had this interstellar cast. Every male actor in Hollywood was either in that film or cut out of that film or wanted to be, anyone you could name.
Yeah.
And yet he would have these huge battle scenes ready. We're going to assault this hill. We've got, you know, anyone you can name lined up in the mud.
Yeah.
And Terrence Malick notices the way the sunlight's falling on a particular blade of grass, and he's going to film that.
Right.
Maybe for a couple of hours.
Right, right, right.
That's Ghostbird.
Yeah,
that's
no, absolutely. Doing. Well, and the Jim Caviezel character in The Thin Red Line seems to be the sanest character in the film.
Right.
Because he's got this quasi-Buddhist mentality.
And he's looking around and he's just noticing things. And there's no words in that film.
Right, yeah.
Hardly. And yeah, he's always looking around and noticing something. And then, like you say, the camera just sits there.
And one of the problems you have to deal with as a reader is that there's a huge part of you that wants to know what happens in the battle.
Yeah.
Just like there's a huge part of you that wants wants Ghostbird to just keep moving and explaining.
Right.
But she can't.
Yeah.
And in a way, she's beyond explaining because this is the real deal.
Well, and it feels like, I mean, by the end of it, that she's, you know, like whatever, you know, the echoes of the biologist's, you know, life in her mind, you know, have like led her to make all these assumptions about what she's for, or has like created some confusion for her. But ultimately she has led The director and or grace and control into acceptance. She's been like a midwife for them. Into
right.
This yeah. is how
they,
it is.
They,
yeah.
They've been fighting it in their ways. Grace maybe at surviving well, but
right.
the fighting
but she's
this
at
futile
the end of her rope.
Civil
I mean,
war.
Right.
Yeah.
When
right.
they find Grace, she's days away from
she's
not surviving.
She's the
anymore.
Japanese soldier yeah. still fighting World War II.
Right.
She's you know.
Right.
And nature's growing around her, and no one's there anymore. And yeah. she's still hiding with a rifle
yeah.
in the lighthouse.
Yeah,
it's brilliant.
But with that time dilation effect, it's like World War II ended yesterday, and someone's been
absolutely
you know, like yeah. a kamikaze hiding out, bugged out for years. And
absolutely.
Years. Yeah. Kate.
Yeah,
you had some
of
issues.
Time dilation.
Yes.
Well, they're not really issues. They're more okay. like questions because there were some things I observed and I wondered if you guys had any thoughts about them because I actually am not sure what it means. Okay. One was when they discover the corpse of the moaning creature and it had been 18 months, the calculated 18 months maximum since the death of the psychologist in the form of the moaning creature. And that the decomp was much
more advanced.
Much more advanced than that. Now, to me, 18 months in a swamp is a really long time. And I'd be amazed there was anything left at all with all this wildlife and dampness and everything. And because I've seen in like Brooklyn a pigeon go from like fresh dead pigeon on the sidewalk to desiccated corpse to just some spindly white bones to nothing at all. In 2 weeks maximum. So what does that mean? I don't think it's a lack of knowledge. I think it's on purpose. And like the idea that a year and a half wouldn't be enough for massive decomp on a strange corpse seems strange to me. And I have one more example, which I'm just curious about.
Well, do we have any thoughts
yeah.
about...
Do boggy swamps not preserve?
They do.
Oh, maybe.
Piltdown Man in the peat.
Yeah.
He's buried in an anoxic situation.
And she's in a similar.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, she's up there, though, not buried. But, yeah, maybe so.
But you're right. There are things like that. I don't quite get it. But I don't think it's for lack of thinking on
exactly.
Vandermeer's part.
That's why I'm asking the
exactly,
question.
Right,
because I'm
right.
like, this is something weird. And I don't think it's because he doesn't know about decomp rates. And
yes.
I feel like there's something I'm not 100% sure if I'm getting. And you're right. It might be like a...
maybe it's supposed to pique your interest. And,
yeah.
and he is trying to tell you.
I think there are things like that that are little kind of nubs and bumps
yeah.
that make you go, huh. That doesn't make sense.
Didn't you think something weird about the hole
right,
in the lens?
Yeah, and then...
Well, Mark had a really interesting thing to say about that.
Do tell, okay. because I'm like, what?
Is there not some kind of interstellar thing that embeds itself in the lens? And is the hole
right.
not made by the Science and Science Brigade trying to take a sample?
Digging it out.
Lens?
Right.
And it flying out the window, landing in the grass, and then Saul finds it stings him, and then he begins to decompose.
Oh, because maybe this is from another planet or
something. There's some kind of, at some point, and I can't remember whose account this is in, but this idea of it coming from far away. And the idea that maybe someone posits, maybe control, that... the rabbits disappear and then maybe they reappear on some other dimension, other
right.
planet. Far away. But it's guesswork.
Right.
We don't understand. We don't know.
But yeah. But Kate, if I remember correctly, when we discussed this, your issue was how quickly the Saul repaired the lens.
Yeah, it was such a strange thing. There was like allegedly like, and they did make. They did talk about the like the value and like the transport of the lens. Like this is an. Old,
it's
heavy
a special,
and valuable,
yeah.
something very special, and like, and there it is, and a hole in it, and then Saul somehow repairs a hole in a lens without it actually being actually elaborated on as that being a very big deal. I mean, you know, he's going to consider whether he's going to put poison out for the armadillo damage, and he's maybe going to repair a ladder,
mm-hmm.
and he's going to do this and that. Oh, and, I don't know, repair
well,
an ancient
fantastic.
And valuable lens?
Well, that's what's
what?
Fantastic. It's the, at various points, characters don't realize the important detail that we might say, hang on, go back.
Yeah.
But they whiz past it because they are, especially
they're
early
in
on,
it.
Saul. So he doesn't yeah. understand the extent of the what's going to happen.
No, of course not.
And
like,
perhaps
what was
he
that
is
thing?
An expert on glass repair. I mean, yeah. He is the lighthouse keeper.
Sure, yeah. It's his job.
And it actually, that's really fascinating.
Like, with what? Epoxy? I'm so confused.
Sandpaper and gum.
Maybe he just covered it up with a Band-Aid.
Yeah. No, yeah. Duct tape. But the fact that this would be the site maybe of the wormhole connecting thing to happen is makes all kinds of sense.
Yeah,
that
I think
it was an ancient
and
valuable. A lens is an eye. Yeah. An eye is an opening, is a window.
Yeah.
It warns sailors, but it also lets in light, it refracts light, it does all these. It's really an interesting portal.
Yes.
And what's interesting about this discussion is that going too far with any explanation feels like it feels incorrect somehow.
Well, it feels like you're going into Lowry Town.
It does.
Instead
it feels
of deeper
like,
into
it feels
Area
like,
X.
Yeah, what we need to be more zen about this rather
we do,
than
however,
more
I'm,
detail-oriented. And
I'm
this
fascinated
is the
that
human,
when Saul feels the prick of the thing, we know that from having read the previous
is,
two books,
the, yeah.
we know that Area X has started and it has, quote, infected him.
Yeah.
We know this has happened.
Absolutely.
And so we're observing with interest everything that happens
every
to his
tiny
body.
Cough is
every numbness every
it's
strange
too late. He's done whatever done means he's done
how about that scene in the bar
right
one of the best things I've ever read in my life. I read it like 25 times.
Talk about
him,
it yeah
him eating so much the insatiable hunger, the eating all the oysters, just glurp glurp glurp, like not
the
even dipping them,
playing,
the band playing
and the bloody fingers, the
things getting weird
on the piano keys.
Right.
Just the hungry eating, like the grease dripping and the hungry eating and ordering another round and drinking more and then things getting really weird. It was so good.
Yeah. Well, you know, I feel like a really like ragged grassroots view of the efflorescence of the biota. Like characters are saying things, but it's coming out of the mouth of a different character. And like the distinctions between the, you know, bodies of people in this bar room are getting like in what their bodies can do. And
are insignificant, those distinctions, because it's all part of this one mass organism.
And that's
right.
scary
and
horrific
in a bar.
To Saul in that moment,
sure.
as it would be to any one of us.
Yeah, and
in a
to
bar.
The inhabitants. And you know, what's left of them as people is doesn't really know.
They don't know what's going down, and a lot of blood is flying around, and people are like dismembered and crawling around, and it's mayhem and screaming.
Right, and a feeling of beautiful chaos. Of him like leaving that behind him and realizing that whatever is happening, it's like the dominoes are rolling, and I just, you know, I have to get to the lighthouse.
The interesting question is, in some way, we understand the crawler, the language, even Area X to maybe be this personification of Saul in some way.
Yeah.
Do you wonder if someone else had been pricked by the? Whatever it is,
right?
That Area X would be a completely different thing, because in a way it's fairly benevolent,
right?
But within that, completely horrific.
Yes,
it's not a raging psychedelic morass. It's actually fairly normal and beautiful and recognizable,
right?
As Saul would be.
Well, you know, and that's.
But again, I feel like I'm reaching.
Well, I feel like it's being polite. You know,
yes,
and that in because
and
it's
that can
come
be one of the most terrifying
door.
Things.
Yes.
Baby steps, so we can understand it, or attempt to even maybe approach understanding
a little bit
of it.
Yeah, yeah, like it's whereas if Lowry had been, you know, the window through which this
it would have
thing
been building
through.
Blocks and stomping and
or
it would
dinosaurs.
Have been, it would have been Madison Square Garden.
Uh-huh.
It would have been you know.
So, something we haven't really mentioned. I mean, that Saul was a minister before he was a lighthouse keeper, and he abandoned his ministry, and he's gay, and he has a male lover, and they're very peaceful, and it's a beautiful situation. But what he was seeking as a minister, and like maybe what there was like leaking through the, you know, the whatever it is that forms religion now, but maybe there's like. Like this thing that persisted in him, even as he divested himself from the conventional forms of religion and really from religion at all, and like pursued his passion and his reality, and and remained this, like, I mean, he's this sort of semi-symbolic figure of being a lighthouse keeper and stuff. And he has his lover who's a night fisherman and all this stuff. But, like, this weird, like, nonsense that remains as the scripture really, it describes what's going on. What's taking over?
Yeah,
not the normal scripture,
right?
But the odd, distorted scripture that ends up coming from him.
Well, I feel like his flashbacks to, like, the nausea that he would feel before giving one of these sermons. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, I am a vessel for this voice, but it's like the wrong God.
Yeah, he knew something. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, he was a portal. Uh-huh. Somehow, right. Like, he was the portal. Well, like, they were so aiming called. At him, maybe.
That's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, and if we accept, like, Area X as just the natural condition of nature, of which all of our, like, human delusions of estrangement from it have been, like, this aberration in the history of this biota, then, you know, we can imagine everyone divinely inspired, you know, who's, I mean, every elevated, you know, if we're not, like, you know, excoriating or casting shade on some other race through some genocidal imperative buried in our scripture, most really beautiful religious texts are hearkening back to that kind of knowledge that we are all components of one thing. And perhaps all prophets have been, you know, like the advance guard of Area X, urging us to slough our human concerns. And
Saul being the ultimate prophet.
Yes, the ultimate prophet.
And the most unlikely prophet as well. Yes. Somehow makes
he's given it up.
Right.
He's given it up.
He's a man of few words.
A lot of the prophets were like that, though. They were doubting. They were doubters. They were, I mean, in the traditional canon.
Right.
It's an interesting
parallel.
Yeah, he would never see himself as a chosen one.
Right.
Whereas Lowry...
Right.
Would.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the problem. That's the problem.
It's people like Lowry.
Yeah. Well,
all the good they may do.
Right. Yeah.
There's so much bad creation.
Well, it's genocidal maniac and homicidal misogynist St. Paul versus Jesus, who's like at every stage in his story is, let this cup passeth from me. I don't want to do this. Are you sure?
Exactly.
Yeah.
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 But St. Paul is like, I'm with this. All right. Who am I killing now? Okay, not the Christians. All right, now I'm killing Romans. Right.
It's an age-old story.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Don't give me this burden. I can't take it.
Right. Right. And it's just beautiful that I feel like, in a way, it's the most, you know, human, like, the whole Saul story, his relationship with Gloria, his relationship with Charlie.
Well, isn't
just
it nice
him
to read?
As a person, just beautiful, and it's like, it's in a way the human core of everything that happens, but for it to be coming at the end here.
Mm-hmm. I know.
There's something beautifully perverse about that.
Yeah. It is. It's so rewarding.
Yeah.
It's a beginning that doesn't explain.
Right.
It's like you said, it's circular.
Yeah, in that it's like not just, oh, I can't wait to read these again so that I'll,
I
can connect the dots. It's not about connecting the
no
dots.
Way.
It's,
no.
It's like that. It feels like that's the anatomy of this narrative, that, you know, that you can keep moving through that cycle. And because, you know, what, like, knowing what we know, knowing what becomes of the biologist, what will it be like to read Annihilation again, knowing that she is a prelude to Ghostbird?
Right. We'd probably find it to be very ignorant.
Yes.
Very. At first, I wasn't sure.
right?
I did go back and start reading it for a while. And at first, I was like, wait, is this being written by the biologist? Or... Uh-huh. Like, the replicant,
right.
I mean, you know, is this Ghostbird or is it Ghostbird? Like,
right.
And then first I was actually pretty sure that it was being written by the replicant. Mm-hmm. And then whether or not that would make a big difference or not, only up to a point, like, it would depend whether it made a difference.
I think the voices are very different.
Yeah, they are. And it did become clear that it was not the replicant.
Yeah.
It was the original.
But these,
like,
are the questions that these kind of
and
books
it's interesting.
Ask.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it was interesting. Right. I
identity.
Had to ask myself.
Who are we? Who are these people?
Yeah.
Totally.
The names shift around.
Right.
Yeah.
The director, her account is told in second person.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is not like anybody else's.
Yeah.
It's really advanced.
It's really that's really interesting to me.
Well, yeah. And in this context, I mean, I'm always a fan of that voice just because of the audacity of using it, even though it's striking. Yeah. And in this context, I mean, we are all of these people. If we imagine that Area X is something that's happening, at least in a metaphorical sense, then, you know, I mean, part of the theme is people divesting themselves of their identity. And so, you know, we might as well be the director.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right, as much as anybody.
Yeah. And so that kind of inviting us to, you know.
It does weirdly put us in her shoes in a way that maybe before we couldn't have been, because she was always somehow previous. She was prior.
Right.
The control was sitting in her chair, but he couldn't quite make that leap.
Yeah.
And now we're allowed this privilege of making that leap.
Right.
But at the same time, it makes her feel like, who's speaking to her?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
What knowledge is she being given that like Saul isn't being spoken to like that?
Right.
And yet he might be the first choice to write in that way, but that would be far too simple in a way.
Right. Well, I mean, because of the overlaps in the models of nature and language in this thing, the way that, you know, there's this natural explorescence of language, you know, and that we get the backstory on. But yet there are lots of murky but rich, you know, sort of gray areas there where, okay, we're getting Saul's story in the third person, kind of slanted in the character and texture of his life. But so, I mean, if the ultimate omniscient third person is Area X looking at people and how their lives mm-hmm. are unfolding, then it's almost like those second person episodes with the director. It's, you know, it's the thing that Area X says to you. It's
immediate.
Yeah. And this is, okay, remember who you are. How did you get here? You're very scared right now.
She's hugely important. I mean, because she's the link. She's the one who was there with Saul.
Right.
And went away and then came back.
Yeah.
He was there the whole time.
Sure.
Everyone else came after.
Yeah.
She's the one.
Yeah.
And so I like that second person because it is. You're right. It's remember who you are.
Right.
Remember how this happened. Remember, realize actually what is happening.
Yeah. And the fact that the book ends with this love letter from her to Saul, it's an explanation as to why this whole experience for the planet has been kinder than it could have been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, don't you feel that?
Yeah.
This horror is not quite horror.
Yeah.
Right.
Like it might be perceived as horror, but once you think about it more and understand it more and find acceptance, horror isn't horror.
It's like death,
a subjective viewpoint.
Right.
Yeah.
Death is a horrible thing, except it isn't.
Yeah. And Jeff Vandermeer sounds like a very positive, future-oriented guy and stuff. But, I mean, this really is like a lullaby for the human race. I mean, we could, if we all...
You feel okay in a way.
All is one.
They're going to, eventually, we're all going to be gone.
Uh-huh.
But that's not terrible.
No.
It just is.
Yeah. And here's a narrative scrim to put on that experience where
it's not a bad idea.
Yeah. That this can be like a beautiful, you know, positive thing.
And I haven't spoken to a lot of people about this book. So I imagine there are people who are frustrated by, they wanted more answers.
The narrative uncertainty.
Right.
It's like, and then the way I've thought about this, it's like how do you as a writer set up like this promise? Like at the beginning of the, throughout the books, it's saying, it's Christmas tomorrow. We have presents to open.
Keep going.
And you're waiting for the presents to be opened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But at somewhere along the line, some of those presents are opened, but somehow if you're diverted enough by the food and the company,
yeah.
you get to the end of Christmas Day and you think, oh, we didn't open those presents. Oh, maybe we'll open them tomorrow.
Right.
Maybe we won't.
Yeah.
It seems like somehow he's done that, and that's a very hard thing to do.
Yeah.
And then it's not like they're MacGuffins necessarily.
Right.
But somehow the perspective shifts enough
yeah.
For me to feel satisfied enough and by what he's given me
mm-hmm. right
and
right.
delighted by what he hasn't given me, like the boldness to not yeah. give me more
yeah
I you know
yeah well I feel like the cumulative aesthetic texture of this thing like renders the delights of a more conventional fiction kind of irrelevant. What happens yes. next? Why did this happen?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Why did this person
no,
do
you
that?
Stop asking that.
Yeah.
I mean, you...
Yeah, you should... If you don't,
the first book actually kind of
yeah.
knocks that out of you.
Yeah.
I mean, because it just contains none
sure,
of that.
Sure, sure.
They're tiny little bits, maybe.
But it puts us in this amazing place where we get this interesting distance once we're into the groove of the thing on characters who are still asking those questions.
Right.
They
yeah,
seem like, kind of...
Yeah,
sad.
We're over it. They're
control.
Not.
Control in the second book, you have some hope that yeah. he might be able to make sense of this, even though it feels like it's too late
right.
because everything's mossy and
right.
and everybody's going through the motions.
Sure.
By the third book, you just pity him.
Yeah.
You want to just put your hand on his head and
yeah.
say, it's going to be okay.
Yeah,
and Ghostbird can't explain
point.
It to him, but Ghostbird can just be with him and
right.
comfort him in that way.
Well, you know, and that's why I feel like her human drama and her struggling... You know, she worked through that stuff as the biologist,
right.
and she's still dealing with stuff, but she just this conductor role that she has. I mean, I feel like every version of what happens on the other side of acceptance in this book is positive. You know, I mean, despite the moaning beast in the wilderness, that was Area X, you know, like trying to defend itself or, you know, coming up with possible solutions. But every character that we actually follow into the weave of this thing gets to this place of astonishing understanding. And how horrific or how pleasant we judge that kind of depends on how much Lowry there is in us.
Huh. Right.
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 And I like my things. And I like to know why things are happening because I'm the boss.
I like to know who's winning.
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, better be me.
What's the score? Yeah. Is this going to be on the final exam?
Uh-huh. Right. Yeah. yeah.
And at the very least, I want to exist.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I want to know that I exist. I want to know that I'm here.
Right. And even at that base level, I mean, you know.
You have to give it up.
We all have that.
Which is what the acceptance means, I
think. Sure.
There's a central ego thing we have where we have to think that our individual existence is important, that our tiny problems are huge.
Yeah.
And
or at least
remembering,
that we're here to have them, even if no one gives a shit.
Right.
But like remembering that my life may be worth nothing in the great scheme of things, like the big scheme of things, I find comforting, but it's terrifying as well. If I try and say that to people, hey, don't worry about your boss right now. Uh-huh. Because in a year's time or in 10 years' time, you'll laugh at yourself. Or, you know, in 100 years' time, humanity won't remember you or your boss.
Yeah.
I find that reassuring, but I've repeatedly said these things to people, and they haven't found it reassuring. It's terrifying.
And you wonder why Martin doesn't have any friends.
The struggle between me and my boss is epic. This is the struggle.
Yeah. And you must understand that and agree with me.
Right,
and it's true as well.
Yeah?
It's no,
sure.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
It's not a comfortable existence.
How will I feel? How can I feel better? How can I relieve you of this problem in the next 15 minutes? And,
right.
You know, and there's a Robin Hitchcock song called "Time Will Destroy You Like a Mexican God" on a similar theme. That's actually beautiful.
Nice.
But yes. So the cosmic perspective.
So we need to write a song called "Area X Will Destroy You Like a Mexican God."
Yeah. Yeah. What? Chip, chip, chipper up in the crow's nest. Upside down face, but it still saw a lot. Cruel, magnificent, roasting your people. I am secure at the end of your rod. Cut out my heart and it flies to the ceiling. Time will destroy you like a Mexican god. So the person being sacrificed gets to sing this to their oppressor.
Nice.
Because that's how it all ends up. But that's neither here nor there. Have we any closing thoughts or concerns on the subject of acceptance?
It's not like anything else. You should read it.
And I would say read the whole trilogy. I don't think any book stands on its own in a conventional way.
Right. People who have complained about the, in Amazon reviews and whatnot about the inconclusiveness of the end. Indeed. But I feel like Annihilation stands on its own in a very special way, in that it's sort of a microcosm of everything that happens in the trilogy, and its ambiguities are, because it's book one, you kind of...
Setting it all up in your mind. Not really. I mean, this one actually sets it all up.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, read them all. Never mind. Read them all.
You can come and take us over if we're wrong.
Uh-huh. Well, it's going to anyway. Accept it.
Accept it, Kate.
Uh-huh, right?
I'm going to read them all over again.
Yeah, and over and over again. Any other... moments, thoughts?
Just that there are some really compellingly weird images in this book, but in the trilogy, but by and large, the absence of weirdness is really striking.
Huh.
And it's some of the weirdest points are where you are, you can imagine yourself out in this sunset and suddenly the wind drops.
Yeah.
And there's nothing, there's no sound. And we've all felt that feeling. Is someone watching me? Is something going on?
Right.
No, the wind just dropped.
Yeah.
And now the wind's back, and now the birds are back. But that feeling.
Yeah.
That's where the real weirdness creeps in.
Right.
The real unknowing.
Yeah.
In a way, the kind of disfigured, strange creatures feel like a relief.
Right.
Because it's some kind of explanation to us.
Yeah.
But the real weirdness and is in between the lines. And that's where, like, his conventional language, I say it relatively conventional language.
Right.
It's not falling apart language. It's not dripping with weirdness. It's relatively sane language.
Uh-huh.
The weirdness is in between it.
Yeah.
That's tough to do.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
That's hard to do.
Yes. Yes.
Is it that he's not Salvador Dali, but he's M.C. Escher?
Even M.C. Escher is flashy in his way. You know,
yeah, it's very logical.
Well, yeah. like Magritte, perhaps, where, there are kind of staid scenarios, but there's this one impossible thing happening in the corner.
Right.
They're quietly revolutionary. I mean,
Okay.
Man, all these contenders are awesome, though, and they all have a place in the description of the experience these books.
Yeah, and, and despite, he sets up these plot structures and that, very artfully dissolve into unknowability. But, the wonder that he injects, the creepy wonder that he injects into nature is beautiful and makes me think of, it seems like everyone we talk about reminds me of J.G. Ballard, but but this particular aspect of Ballard that Vandermeer reminds me of is the sort of Vermilion Sands Ballard, where he can, just talk about the opaque anti-human beauty of a desert, like a kind of beauty that that renders even the eye that beholds it irrelevant in its fierce isness. So I'm looking forward, in the wake of having finished this trilogy, to going to the beach again and getting scared.
Excellent.
Yeah, because whatever in me is scared is not good for Area X.
Do you know, we're going to the mountain tomorrow, and perhaps something will happen there.
No doubt. Everything will happen there.
In the consciousness sort of way.
Yeah. Yeah. I will hate to see you go, but if you guys never come back from that, if you melt into your experience,
don't worry about us.
Because we're next.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Awesome. I love it.
Nice. Okay, so shall we wrap this up?
Certainly.
Okay, it has been a great delight to discuss this delightful trilogy of Annihilation, Authority, and Acceptance with my ravishing co-hosts. Me being Jason Squamata, you being...
Pat Janowski.
You being...
Mark Savage.
You being...
Kate Fanker.
Okay. And yes, being is the enemy, as these books have taught us. So thank you for hopping on. We are a Book Circle Online. We are here through the good graces of Maria Menounos. and Menounos and Kevin Undergaro and our LA chapter of Book Circle Online, managed by the brilliant Jeff Masters. We're happy to be here. You can friend me on Facebook. It's SQUAMATA. And do we have any other contact information?
Same. Pat Janowski, JANOWSKI.
Okay, tell her what it's about. Okay, because she gets creeps on her jock all the time, and she wants to know that you're a book lover.
Yeah.
Right.
Hey, okay. I like that. Send me a little message.
Okay, a little message. Message. Mm-hmm. Mark.
Yeah. Mark Savage. Mark. Oh, they're both in the dictionary.
Okay. Yeah. Check it out. Right. And yes,
Kate Fenker, and I'm the only one.
And you are the only one.
I'm not.
And
yet,
and check out her fabulous creations and explorescences on katefenker.com.
Excellent.
Yes. And thank you for keeping it bookish, keeping it circular, and for sloughing all the lineaments of human identity to melt ecstatically into the glory of Area X. This has been Book Circle Online.
From managing editor Jason Squamata, executive producers Maria Menounos, Phil Svitek, and Kevin Undergaro, we would like to thank you for tuning in to Book Circle Online. For more discussion, go to bookcircleonline.com. And if you have comments, questions, or book title suggestions, write us at info@bookcircleonline.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this is Book Circle Online. BCO. Join the circle.